Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 284, Australians and the Steuben Brothers Hunt Gold on the Ridge of White Waters. Gold sends a shiver through the spine of the adventurer. The merest hint drives men to acts of extreme bravery or stupidity. Moderate men and women throw off their cloaks of social anonymity and travel thousands of kilometres in arduous conditions just to lay their hands on a gram or two of the yellow treasure. Gold fever is a pandemic, even in the modern world, although the price of gold fluctuates based on geopolitics and economics. What is this allure? Callous investors of the modern era decry gold bugs and their passions, sneering at the pursuit of a commodity that appears to have very little going for it, other than its scarcity. Despite these days of blockchain, ETFs, polymarket, AI investor hullabaloos, the physical value underpinning billions is bullion. By the 1880s, gold was more than something to lock away in a vault or fashion into a king's crown. It had become one of the world's essential industrial commodities, prized because it does not rust, tarnish, or corrode. It can be beaten into sheets so thin they're almost transparent. There's gold in your mobile phone, your smartphone. Gold leaf adorns the domes of public buildings, including the inside of the White House, church altars, picture frames, spines of expensive books. Dentists relied on it for fillings, crowns, and bridges because it's soft, durable, and chemically inert. Watchmakers and instrument makers used it for precision components that had to resist corrosion, and jewelers transformed it into rings and brooches and chains for an expanding middle class. Gold salts found their way into photography and medicine, and artisans incorporated the metal into fine porcelain, glass, luxury decorative objects. Yet these practical uses consumed only a fraction of the world's output. The overwhelming demand for gold comes from another purpose altogether. The metal underpins the global financial system. Nations mint it into sovereigns and eagles and francs. Banks store it in their vaults as the foundation of currencies, and governments ensure their economic strength by the weight of bullion they possess. Every new reef discovered promises not merely ornaments and luxury goods, but the power to expand credit, finance empires, and reshape the world economy. Geologically speaking, the Witwatersrand gold basin is a unique phenomenon. It is the most immense gold resource with the poorest grade ever discovered. The Witwatersrand makes up one-third of all gold ever mined in the history of planet Earth. 1.5 billion ounces have been extracted from the ever-deepening mine shafts that dot the landscape from east of Johannesburg to the southern Free State, a shallow elliptical dish of the ore that is about 6 meters thick. 300 kilometers long and 160 kilometers wide, it tilts from near the surface in the northeast around Johannesburg to deep into the earth the further south the ore dish extends. Thousands of boreholes have been drilled in this territory, tens of thousands of kilometers of shafts have been sunk and tunnels burrowed beneath and within. So it is truly astonishing, as historian Jay Davenport points out, that geologists are not entirely certain how this basin was created. Take its shape, a near-perfect circle. Some scientists believe it's too remarkable to leave to chance. It must reflect a very early event in the Earth's history when a meteorite impacted the area, or it was a sagging point in the thin proto-crust created by a volcanic hotspot. What is certain is that the ellipse, the gold ore-bearing rock, was laid down starting 3 billion years ago. This puts it in the time zone of the very cradle of earthly life. For the next half a billion years, the basin was filled to a depth of 7 kilometers with sediments eroded from an arc of greenstone mountains, which were found north of this early Achaean lake. If you close your eyes, perhaps you can imagine this ancient landscape with a massive lake, twice the size of Lake Superior, a distant haze of mountains to the north, and flowing down braided rivers, snaking and bending, twisting towards the lake, carrying silt and materials to deposit in large alluvial deltas, massive versions of the Okavango. The heavy materials, like gold, were deposited first, building up valuable layers around the shoreline. Other valuables, green diamonds, carbon, uranium, iron, pyrites, chromite, were also deposited in this pre-dinosaur time of Earth's development. The thickest layer of gold lay along the shoreline, and its value diminishing further away. That's the reason why earlier mining operations on the Witwatersrand enjoyed high yields of 205 grams per ton, while modern mines only extract between 3 and 6 grams per ton. Over millions and millions of years, heat and pressure built up with the sediments that began to press the basin, the ancient lake, which was eventually covered in younger rock formations. It warped and tilted. The northwestern rim became exposed in an area known as the Central Rand, but bits popped out at outcrops near Klaksdorp, Vredefort, Heidelberg, Bethel, Oudendalsrus. On the Witwatersrand itself, three main bands of ore have prevailed. They are conglomerates, a sedimentary rock composed of rounded pebbles courtesy of being washed down those ancient rivers, mixed with fine-grained material known as banquet reefs. The name banquet reef has an unexpectedly domestic origin. The prospectors and geologists who first examined the gold-bearing rock on the Witwatersrand thought it resembled a traditional Dutch pastry known as banquet staff, a rich almond-filled roll. When sliced, the pastry reveals a scattering of almond pieces embedded throughout the filling. Likewise, the Witwatersrand conglomerate consists of rounded white quartz pebbles embedded in a finer matrix, giving the rock the appearance of nuts set in dough. To Dutch and Afrikaans-speaking miners, the resemblance was obvious, and the name banquet soon became attached to the conglomerate beds. There are three important banquets along the Witwatersrand: Main Reef Leader, and South Reef, known by geologists as the Main Reef Series. These three reefs, the banquets, have produced a significant majority of the Witwatersrand's gold. On the far west rand, the reef is known as Carbon Leader, while in Klaksdorp in the Free State, it's the Vaal Reefs that are mined, while in western area, Western Reefs. These collectively yielded over one-third of the world's gold. Standing south of Johannesburg these days and looking at the high ground, the Witwatersrand gives you very little idea about why early settlers called this the Ridge of White Waters. It's all developed now. There are the inevitable townhouse development complexes and shopping malls. It's industrialized and urbanized land that has obfuscated the look and feel of the landscape. As the early trekkers made their way north from the Vaal River in the mid-1830s, they were struck by the beautiful vista of a broad ridge about 100 kilometers across, dotted with waterfalls in summer. To give you an idea about what this must have looked like, go visit the Walter Sisulu Botanical Gardens in Roodepoort to take a look at the stunning waterfall there. The entire ridge was covered with these waterfalls, particularly spectacular after heavy rains. Places like Roodepoort, Melville, Parktown, Upper Houghton, Orange Grove, Bedford View, these were all covered in clear running falls, long since channeled and drained, the silver cascades gone. The Australians have a lot to do with gold discoveries in South Africa, particularly Henry Lewis, who'd been lured to Southern Africa by reports of pay dirt in the Eastern Transvaal around Pilgrim's Rest. That was in 1874, and like many other diggers, he wandered about and eventually discovered alluvial gold on the farm Blaubank near Rustenburg. The Jennings brothers owned the farm and allowed the Australian to prospect. Lewis then wrote to the Volksraad in Pretoria informing them of good news. Gold Commissioner William Saunders was hired and dispatched to Blaubank when Burgers arrived, having been told of treasure. In 1874, the farm near Rustenburg was a ward of the Witwatersrand, which had been named before Johannesburg was ever founded. Quartz veins were too thick and deep to be mined by hand. It needed machines, so the diggers petitioned for permission to amalgamate nearly 100 claims and pool their cash. Machines are expensive, particularly mining machines like steam drills and crushers. Ironically, the company they launched was called Nil Desperandum Cooperative Quartz Company, with a pooled capital of $4,250, a few million US dollars today. Nil Desperandum is Latin for don't despair. By May, the company had drilled 100 feet at it into the hillside, but very little gold was produced. By 1878, the total yield was a measly 130 ounces, barely enough to pay running costs. Nil Desperandum was forced into liquidation, Omnia Desperanda, all is lost, replacing Nil Desperandum. The Blaubunk mine still exists, at least the ghost of the mine, part of the protected natural environment of the scenic Magaliesberg, about a kilometer to the southwest of the town of Magaliesberg. Search for it on Google Maps, and you'll find the craters and diggings etched into the landscape in eerie memory of the past. Into our tales steps another Australian, a man who would go on to be described as quite incompetent. Alfred Watson Armfield was a mining engineer commissioned by Transvaal Administrator Sir Theophilus Shepston, and between August and November 1878, he trundled around the Transvaal with his assistants prospecting. I suppose you can't really blame him for his incompetence. His geological experience in Australia was limited to panning the rivers. South Africa was a whole different banquet of reefs. Armfield sieved gravel and sand along watercourses starting northwest of Blaubunk and down through the Witwatersrand, finally reporting that he, in no instances, obtained more traces of gold. The geological formation is intersected by barren-looking quartz veins. Diabolical Australian accent aside, there was gold, he said, but pitifully little. Gold-bearing conglomerate rocks were quite a rare geological phenomenon, so you can't really blame Alfred Armfield for his pessimism. 3 years later, in 1881, Dutch diamond digger Jan Bankies made his way to the Witwatersrand from Kimberley and stumbled across an outcrop of the conglomerate on the farm Vlakfontein. That was in the southwestern corner of the Transvaal near Krugersdorp. Bankies was far more upbeat, writing that, "It is my belief that these rocks will ultimately prove to be rich in gold." Remarkably accurate prediction, you would say. His friend Stefanus Minnaar also found traces of gold on his farm Kromdraai, 16 kilometers north of where Krugersdorp is today. Minnaar and Bankies launched a mining syndicate in Potchefstroom and pursued the yellow metal spasmodically until 1884. Another group of prospectors on the nearby farm of Tweefontein also discovered veins of gold, and in 1884, the Tweefontein Company set up a 10-stamp battery, the first crushing machinery to be erected in the Transvaal. Eventually, Tweefontein operations and Kromdraai pooled their resources to establish the Kromdraai Gold Mining Company, but it only managed a paltry few hundred ounces over the next few years. So far, nothing special. It was into this scattered story that our next hero appears, and one we met some time back talking about Pilgrim's Rest gold discoveries. Fred Struben was the son of a Dutch naval officer who arrived in South Africa in the 1850s. He disembarked in Cape Town with a thirst for knowledge and a lust for adventure. Fred had taught himself the basics of geology, and he had a genius for reading hidden treasures. It was Fred who had explored promising outcrops of rock in Natal, Swaziland, Eastern Transvaal, the Waterberg, and in the Orange Free State. Fred Struben, though, didn't do it all by himself. His brother Harry was the financial power behind Fred's rock-scratching projects. At the end of 1883, Fred made his way from the Eastern Transvaal to the Witwatersrand, having heard the stories about Kromdraai and Tweefontein. After visiting the two mining areas, he was convinced that the entire region was covered by an auriferous quartz vein, and that the nearby farms of Stakfontein and Swartkrans should also be gold-bearing. Just for the record, an auriferous quartz vein is a distinct light-colored mineral fracture in rock that contains embedded deposits of gold formed when fluids cool deep within the earth's crust. Struben was one of the earliest folks to put two and two together when it came to the ancient quartz formations, that there had been some kind of lake millions and millions of years earlier into which rivers drained. Fred Struben dug a test dig 25 meters deep and crushed ore, extracting 2 ounces of gold per ton. This is where his brother comes into focus, because on the basis of this first dig, Fred convinced older Booty Harry to use some of the family fortune to buy both Sterkfontein and Swartkrans farms for £2,800, about £500,000 today. The Strubens had made their money from transport riding and farming and trading ventures, and Harry decided to back his younger brother despite some misgivings. These Strubens were not romantic fortune hunters living from one pan of gravel to the next. Harry had already made a small fortune before gold transformed the Witwatersrand. Beginning as a transport rider with a single ox wagon in the early 1850s, he built a thriving haulage and trading business, linking Durban with Pretoria, as many do today, expanded into commercial farming, and steadily invested his profits in land across the Transvaal. Those businesses financed years of expensive prospecting, while his younger brother Fred supplied the geological instinct. Together, they became uniquely positioned to make the discovery that would point the world towards the richest gold field ever found. They formed the Sterkfontein Junction Mining Syndicate in 1884, and Fred set to work, sinking shafts 50 metres into the conglomerate. Then he hit a snag. Groundwater flooded his tunnels. All attempts at diverting the underground stream failed. During this frustrating period, though, Fred Steuben didn't give up. He investigated the Witwatersrand more broadly. And in doing so, he discovered the world's most valuable gold-bearing conglomerate of the Witwatersrand Basin. At least, that's what he told English journalist and fellow gold explorer Edward Mathers in an interview in 1887. "I showed these conglomerate beds to several parties, amongst them an expert, and was well laughed at for my trouble." Meanwhile, Harry Steuben began buying up farms along the Witwatersrand, including Wilgespreit, 15 kilometres away from Sterkfontein. When Fred investigated the property, he spotted a 4-foot-thick vein. It appeared to be so rich in gold, he named it Confidence Reef. Between December 1884 and May 1885, the two brothers collected rich samples, revealing a phenomenal content of almost 1,000 ounces of gold and 36 ounces of silver to the ton. Stunned, the Steubens headed off to Pretoria to inform Paul Kruger's government of their rich discovery and then conducted a public assaying of their ore in front of a gobsmacked Volksraad in a famous incident in June 1885. Assaying was the indispensable bridge between hope and investment. Every prospector could hold up a glittering piece of quartz and claim it contained gold, but only an assay could answer the question of how much gold was actually present. Without that, the reef was merely an interesting geological curiosity. With an assay, it became, or failed to become, a mine. The assay is a chemical analysis which determines the quantity of valuable metal contained in an ore sample. By the 1880s, the standard method for gold was the fire assay, where a carefully weighed sample of crushed ore was mixed with lead and fluxes, heated in a furnace until the precious metals were absorbed into molten lead and then reheated in a porous cupel, a heat-resistant container which holds and separates molten liquids. The lead oxidized away, leaving behind a tiny bead of precious metals. That bead was weighed, allowing the assayer to calculate the gold content in ounces or pennyweights per ton of ore. Differences of only a few grains could determine whether a mine would be nil disparandum or omnia disparanda. This was especially important on the Witwatersrand, where the gold was often invisible to the naked eye. Unlike the spectacular nuggets of Australia or California, Rand gold occurred as microscopic particles locked within quartz veins and the banked conglomerates. Harry Steuben told the Volksraad that the Witwatersrand could become the richest gold field in South Africa and urged the government to support mining. President Paul Kruger and the Volksraad were sufficiently impressed that they promised their political support for developing the industry's legal framework. Little did everyone know, the country was about to enter an extremely fractious phase leading directly to the Anglo-Boer War. The Steubens were granted a mining concession over Wilgespreit and quickly installed crushing equipment. By the end of December 1885, their stamp battery was in full swing, but their confidence in Confidence Reef was slightly misplaced. The initial samples just so happened to have been taken from a rich chimney within the reef. They crushed 400 tons of quartz, but only 260 pounds worth of gold was recovered. The mine lasted another year before the gold-bearing vein was pinched out. Desperanda set in, to abuse the Latin once more. But the word was out. Witwatersrand had gold. The Volkstem newspaper published a report about the assay. "Mr. H.W. Steuben of Wilgespreit exhibited gold quartz of great richness." By the beginning of 1886, Dozens of fortune hunters rolled in from across southern Africa, many from nearby eastern Transvaal, others from Kimberley, some from across the world, all set to work searching for their treasure. It may come as a surprise, but the discovery of the motherlode at Langlachter, south of the Witwatersrand Ridge, was purely accidental. What probably won't come as a surprise by now is to hear that some of the folks involved were Australian. There's a great deal of historical disinformation and debate about who exactly discovered this motherlode. Many believe it was Australian George Harrison. Others say it was more likely to be George Walker. At least we're sure about one thing. Whomever it was who accidentally discovered the Langlachter motherlode was called George. With that prosaic note, it's time to end. Next episode, we'll join the Georges and their colleagues to unearth more quartz reefs and hear about the widow Oosthuizen on the farm Langlachter, as well as her brother Gerhardus. There'll be grand entrances by George Harrison and George Walker, more investments by the Steuben brothers. Then we'll share a bottle of peach brandy with a blacksmith named George Honeyball. He was the gold influencer who was going to spread the word of the motherlode like wildfire. Boy, if any more Georges feature next episode, I'll wear out the G key on my trusty MacBook. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. You can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, happy hunting.